Good Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a pretty good start so far this morning. Hi there, it's at 10:07. Welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker is settling in for another hour of Science Files. It's coming up this hour, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Next hour, it's your turn to sound off. We've got an open hour ahead at 11. We call it Manic Monday, and of course, as always, in our open hours, anything goes. UPEI political scientist Don Deserud will join me after the news at noon. We'll talk politics, of course, and the federal election campaign heading now into week number two. And we'll hear a Halifax history moment this afternoon with historian John Boileau. But this hour, it is time for Science Files. And joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to
you. Good morning.
I finally got to watch this two-hour PBS special on the Voyager.
Okay, I was glad that it didn't go with something about the History Channel.
Yeah, no, this is PBS, and I, yeah. I think it was Nova, and I think they do an excellent job. But what really stood out at me is after the Voyager 1 or 2, or maybe both, entered interstellar space, which interstellar space is that big nothing between solar systems, right?
It's sort not of, completely nothing, but yeah, there's not very much there. Okay, I agree with that.
Yep. But it's going to take one of these, if not both of these spacecraft, 14,000 years before it hits the next star system.
14.
What? Is it 40, is it?
Yeah.
I said that, well, that just tells you the immenseness of what we're dealing with out there.
Yeah, it's like the interstellar beetle.
Yeah,
it's about the size of Volkswagen Beetle car.
And this thing is traveling at a pretty rapid speed.
Yeah, 30,000 miles an hour. But, I mean, that tells you how big space is. So it's not going past the closest star system. It's a little bit further away than that, but it's going to take a long time to get there.
So in 14,000 years, we hope that some
don't
other
wait
civil
up.
Seriously, which is kind of disappointing. I was hoping that somebody would find it before that, but
well, who knows what's out there, but I'm not holding my breath. Let's put it that way.
But still, and their voyages to Saturn and Neptune, I mean, some pretty amazing photos and discoveries.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these were the grand tours of the solar system, as they're known. I mean, absolutely revolutionized our knowledge of Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune.
And their moons.
Oh, for sure. And the ring systems as well. I mean, just amazing science all right there.
Yep. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. But 40,000 years. I just said, wow. Yeah. That tells you everything we need to know about the immenseness.
Well, it's called space for a reason.
Yeah, I guess so, right?
There's a lot of it.
And what is the one they're going to hit in 40,000 years. Well, what is it?
I knew you were going to ask me. I think it might possibly be Barnard's star, but I'm probably wrong.
Okay. But, again, the immenseness of space, a billion stars out there with a billion other planets surrounding these stars, and someday we'll see. A new survey out, this is interesting, a new survey out suggests that the trust Canadians place in science may be eroding. This is sampling done by Ipsos for the multinational 3M company. It found that 32% of respondents were skeptical about science. That's up 25% from the previous survey. It says about one-third of respondents felt scientists were swayed by government or corporate agendas. And another 30% said they only believe science that aligned with their personal beliefs. How disturbing is that to you, Doctor?
I don't find that surprising at all.
No?
At all. I mean, so where you've got to look at this is the fact that, with some exceptions, scientists are pretty disconnected from the public at large. I mean, there are actually groups of people who think that's how it should be. I obviously don't agree with that. I'm quite happy to come on and talk to people about science because I think I'm paid but through taxpayers' money, largely, not all of it, but largely a lot of it is. And so I feel we have a duty to communicate that, because if it just sort of like sits in books that no one reads, what's the point?
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, not everyone is doing that. And we do have very different language. So anyone who remembers the issue of, what was it called? The climate gate a few years ago, when they actually took the language that was used in emails and went, haha, look, these scientists are really disingenuous. They're trying to fake things and so on, because they're using quote unquote tricks.
Yeah.
And so we use the word trick to mean a mathematical process. Well, I have a neat trick for turning a data into this format. And it's said a lot. And I'm super careful now when I give a lecture because I don't want the students to think I'm trying to do something that's deceptive.
Yep.
I'm just talking about something as like a magician's trick being a very clever thing that you do and it works. So that language can be, and it's the same thing with theory, right? Because in theory, in science, a theory in science is something that you can apply, particularly in physics. It will have a very specific mathematical framework. You can derive how things will evolve over time and so on. And you can apply that and say, does it match what we see? And so Einstein's theory of general relativity, we don't have anything that disproves it right now. But people go, but it's just a theory. Yeah. And you're like, oh, that doesn't matter. It's still incredibly, incredibly good. Right. And so even though we use the theory to mean something not very precise in everyday language, in science, the word theory can mean something that's actually incredibly accurate that we've never seen go wrong anywhere, right? So there are lots of things that can cause people to distrust science. The whole issue of corporate interest, government interest, I can say personally that I'm pretty darn sure that even though most scientists are funded by governments, they really, the vast majority of the time, don't want to do things that are furthering particular government agendas,
yeah,
because it's just not in your interest to do so as a scientist, because you have all of these people reviewing your work. And if you start doing things that are dishonest, you're going to get called on it really quickly, right? And that's the thing that I find frustrating with the whole climate discussion, that people say, oh, yeah, there's all these scientists just trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. My God, if someone came up with a theory that basically showed that climate change was caused by, I don't know, something not that humans were doing, and could prove that rigorously, that person would be an absolute star. Hmm. But no one's come up with that for what seems to be fairly obvious reasons that we are the people behind it.
So, well, but we do know a lot of people skeptical about the whole climate change issue.
Right, and so it's easy to make people skeptical. Right. And all you have to do to make someone skeptic is just go, are you sure about that?
Yeah,
and that's another thing. I mean, I could do a whole Zurowski hour on this, but I mean, we can go on about this forever. But one of the things is that people misunderstand about science is the tendency to think science is about absolute certainty. And we don't work in that. In fact, ironically, I'm going to be giving a talk on Wednesday night at Keshen Goodman Library. And one of the things I'll talk about is the important process of doing science involves not only doing science and getting out an average, you also actually have to get out an uncertainty. How uncertain are you about your particular thing? And that's almost sometimes as important as the answer that you get.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones here. Peter's got a question for us this morning. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you guys this morning?
We're doing great. How are you?
Awesome. I've had a question in the back of my mind for quite a while, and today's opening lines kind of triggered it.
All right. Mm-hmm.
You have a satellite heading out, as in like Voyager,
mm-hmm,
which they use the slingshot method to gain velocity.
Yep.
Okay, it's coming into, we'll call it Saturn, I'm not sure which ones were used. Is it a set velocity or is it still accelerating before it becomes under the influence of a planet's gravity?
All right. How does that sling thing
okay,
work?
So it's going to pick up a little bit of acceleration as it comes in. That's inevitable.
Okay.
It's kind of falling around in a certain
way.
Right,
but
if you want
before
to think about
it becomes
way
under the influence, it's a set velocity. It's not accelerating, correct?
It would probably have been fairly close to being constant, but remember a gravitational field doesn't just stop, right?
It goes on for a long time. Okay. It's so gradual. Now, it comes in and goes around a planet, and as it becomes more and more under the influence of the gravitational field, it speeds up.
Mm-hmm.
Fully understand that. But when it passes the planet, the gravity, would it not tend to try to slow it back down?
Yes, it would. It absolutely would.
So you don't, what, it doesn't come back to a nil amount? It's just...
You got it. You answer your question yourself. So what happens with the slingshot is you pick up a net acceleration. What happens to the planet itself is it actually slows down an incredibly tiny, tiny, minuscule amount as a result of that, and you get a net boost to you because of that interaction. So you answered your question. It does slow down, but at the end of it, when you subtract off the increase versus the decrease, you've got a net increase at the end.
Hmm.
So essentially where you've gained your speed is during that process.
Yeah, you literally rob the planet of a little bit of its orbital angular momentum in doing that.
But the only real time it gains any real amount of speed is during this process or when it passes and is no longer, say, in the
I would say you've got to think about it being over the whole interaction that it has. That's how it gains the speed, over the whole interaction.
Okay, but in the end, it has, the satellite has no net gain?
It does. It has a net gain, yes.
Just because of the slowdown of the planet?
Yep. It's an absolutely minuscule amount of slowdown of the planet, but that's where you're getting the energy from. Yeah.
But because of the mass difference, that small amount for the planet transforms into a relatively large amount for the satellite.
You got it.
And something I learned from watching that PBS special, by the way, is that this slingshot effect cut 20 years off the voyage.
Oh, yeah.
That if it had been a direct Earth to Pluto or whatever, it would have taken 20 years longer than the slingshot around the planet.
Yeah, I mean, you can do really complicated stuff with slingshots if you really want to get into it. So,
and one more follow-up to that. When you're doing a slingshot, do they always go, okay, say you're looking down at our solar system, call from north to south, and the planets are orbiting in a counterclockwise direction?
Yep.
Do you always slingshot on the outside? Because if you went on the inside, would it not tend to bend it and put it straighter out from the center?
I think you do. I think you're right. I think you always do that. Certainly you did on the Voyagers, and I think that's true for the slingshots we've done for other things as well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Okay.
Thanks for the call, Peter.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, you can also reach us via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a comment or a question. Our Twitter handle, @TheRickHowe Show. 10-18, our time right now. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob right after this. Dan 21 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker with us here. He's from St. Mary's University. He's an astrophysicist, don't you know? And he's here for Science Files. And at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255 is the number to call if you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning. You can also email us, as I mentioned, and Mark's done that. He says, early Saturday evening, I saw an extremely bright object traveling from west to east. Was this the International Space Station? It was much too bright, he says, to be a satellite. And he says, from the time I saw it on the horizon, it was gone in just a couple of minutes. How fast might this thing have been traveling? What do you know about this, Dr. Rob?
So Saturday night, what's that?
Saturday evening, he says.
Saturday evening. Yeah.
Might have been the space
station. That probably was. Yeah. Yep. 8:13 p.m. It was visible for about 5 minutes. So, that could have been it.
And you just see a light. You don't really see an outline, or do you?
No, you don't see the outline. I mean, you can see the outline with a small telescope, but I mean, most of the time, no, you're just seeing a bright light.
And it passes over this province on a regular basis, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was overhead. In fact, I think it was actually overhead looking at this table. Twice on Saturday. Ooh. So, you would have been able to see it. So, and it's going around every 90-odd minutes or so. And so, it's not surprising you can see it. So there's a whole bunch of times possibly this week that you can see it too. So, it happens fairly regularly.
Excellent. I'll have to peek up there.
And if you want to, you can go to spotthestation@nasa.gov and it will tell you when it's over.
Oh, okay. There you go. Asteroid breakup 466 million years ago may have triggered our ice age. Dust from this likely collision took 50,000 years to reach Earth, and when it did, it froze us up, apparently, Doctor.
Yeah, so, that's one of the things that's always difficult to talk about in terms of, like, impacts, and that's the post-impact. You have all of that heating that can happen when you actually have the impact, but once it's happened and it's sort of, like, spewed all of this stuff into the atmosphere, then you get the scenario that for a long time was called the nuclear winter scenario, where you get a lot of particulate up in the air, reflecting both heat out and also stopping heat coming through as well. So that's probably, I would guess, exactly dust. Yes, dust from likely collision took 50,000 years to hit Earth and so on. So, I mean, this is not unexpected. I mean, the Earth has gone through entire periods of having much colder climate than we have now. So,
There was a volcanic eruption back in the 1800s that resulted almost in a nuclear winter. Krakatoa. Thanks very much.
I mean, Krakatoa impacted the climate for at least 5 years, apparently. So, absolutely, this can be a problem.
Let's stick to space here for a moment. And Elon Musk tweets a sneak peek at his vision for SpaceX's Starship mega rocket. I believe you kind of referred to this as Every child's dream of flying in a
water towers that can fly.
It looks just like that. I mean, is that what this thing's going to look like?
So, in short, it will look better than it looks there. But so these look like they're building just giant water towers because they're cylinders about the size of a water tower, and then they're putting fins on them. And so they did the first sort of launcher. The Star Hopper, as they called it, a while ago, and that was successful. That was pretty impressive.
So what's the significance of what's this spacecraft going to do here?
So these are the Mark 1 and Mark 2, as they're calling them, prototypes of the Starship. They're not the full-size Starship. The whole, they have the BFR rocket, as we talked about, will be one giant booster with probably like 30-plus engines on it, and then on top of that will sit what's called Starship. And so before they actually build a full-size prototype, they want to test a number of the technologies. So what they're doing right now is that they have two distinct developments of the prototype, the Mark 1 and Mark 2, one's in Florida, one's in Texas. And they're having a competition to build them together and then see, eventually the goal is to fly them into suborbital flights by, he said, by the end of this year. I don't believe that's going to happen. But nonetheless, it's going to happen fairly soon. So the impressive thing is, they are just building outside. And so because they're building outside, people can take pictures and post them on the internet. And so Musk kind of gets out ahead of it and starts posting pictures so people can see the progress.
Is this for the Mars mission or what's the point
this of this? This is technology development for the Mars mission. I think that's the best way to put it. They've built this new Raptor engine, which uses liquid oxygen and liquid methane, which by all accounts is actually really quite good. And so now they're looking at all of the flight characteristics of the vehicle and building a prototype or two prototypes to test that. And so that's going to be really interesting. They have some kind of far-out technologies that they want to do for landing on Mars. But first of all is doing flight tests of the Starship, getting it up close to sort of orbital, not quite orbital as far as I'm aware, because it's only going to be a three-engine rocket with one stage, and then coming back down again.
So, well, is this being, you know, developed in conjunction with NASA?
Yeah. So a lot of information will have come from NASA. I mean, Musk is on record as saying they couldn't do the things they do without NASA. So absolutely there will be technologies in there that have actually find their genesis within NASA research.
Seems to me he's far and ahead of the others who are into this commercialized space program. Is that a good assessment?
Well, the thing that he's far ahead on is, quite frankly, the public relations side, right?
Well, he's good at that, yeah.
So he is very active on Twitter, and he's obviously posting this stuff on Twitter so people can see it, but he will also answer questions. So one of the big questions, this is really interesting, one of the big questions is, when you have a two-stage rocket, if something goes wrong, right, on the launch pad, like your booster blows up, and you've got another bit on the top with the people in it, you've got to get that bit on the top with the people on it off and away really quickly, rescue systems.
Okay.
So NASA had rescue systems built for, say, the Apollo that literally would pull off the capsule with the people and just take it off really, really fast. With the BFR rocket, you've got to move something that's a very, very heavy rocket very, very, very quickly. And a lot of people were posting this question to him saying, well, how are you going to save the astronauts if there's actually a kind of incident on the launch pad? And he said, well, you know, our new engines, we can spin them up incredibly quickly and just literally blow the Starship off the booster as the booster's exploding. Whether they can actually do that or not, whether it has the structural integrity to do that, is another thing altogether. But nonetheless, they're saying that they can spin up. Normally, it takes a few seconds. If you've ever watched a launch, you'll see like the countdown's doing 10, 9, 8, engine start, 7, 6, 5. Yeah, you can see everything sort of like going on. The turbo pump's kicking in. Right, they're saying they can do that in fractions of a second.
What about the Challenger? I guess there was no time or means of
a Challenger was just basically a completely out of control explosion. I mean, you didn't know anything. With Challenger, there are theories that potentially if there had been some kind of separate ejection system, you could have sort of blown that away from the rest of it and so on, but they didn't have that, obviously.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yep. 1028, Dr. Rob Thacker is with us here on a Monday morning. This is Science Files. We're going to take a break here in a moment for a news update, and then more with Dr. Rob. And if you've got a question for us this morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob Thacker after a news update, and it is coming up next.
It was in Bob Cajun. Saw the constellations reveal themselves.
Oh, Katie getting a little creative with her music there, Dr. Rob. Indeed. 1033, here's Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files on a Monday morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Let's talk about the, well, the we week of climate action began on Friday, culminating, ending this coming Friday with a climate strike. And literally around the world, a couple of million people took part in demonstrations from Australia to Hong Kong to Germany to right here in Halifax. You know, one of the here's the headline: "We can't wait anymore." That was the message from one of the one of the young students that spoke here on Friday. I mean, how you know? I guess the question is how desperate are we in regards to this whole climate issue here? How much time do we have before we can turn back the clock?
Well, it's challenging because depending upon how you were to suddenly change your emissions profile, you could change the date which you actually have to take action. But the point of all of this is it's always cheaper to act earlier.
Yeah.
Right? Because you can start getting yourself on a progressive timeline whereby you can actually do these things in a step-by-step fashion. Ironically, really ironically, the economists have been saying, no, it's the other way around. And you're like, why? Because, well, because every generation has more wealth than the previous generation.
Mm-hmm.
So you should wait for the next generation to pay for this because they'll have more money than you do.
But the next generation is not prepared to wait any longer, it
seems. And that's not only necessarily true because that assumes you have consistent growth. And if you don't have consistent growth because basically you reach a point where you have to have sustainable development because you're messing up the climate, then that's no longer true. And you have to pick up the tab, as it were, across a couple of generations, probably.
So the situation is dire is what you're telling us here right now.
I'm never
is that too strong
I'm
a
never,
word?
I'm never an alarmist, right? I don't, because what I don't like about alarmist wording is that you can put some people to the point where, oh, it's hopeless. Right. And it's not hopeless. We can actually have an impact on the climate if we start getting it together. But where we do need agreement is internationally. Right. We all have to do this. And that's one of the most significant challenges. It's one of the reasons why this is a struggle for politicians, because we as a country, Canada, has lived for a very long time taking oil out of the ground, burning that oil, selling that oil and so on. And we have developed our economy largely through that and other aspects, obviously. And then you have developed countries who turn around and say, but you've been able to grow. Why can't we grow?
Yeah.
Right? And so you get into this interaction, which is generally, most of the time, negative.
Yeah.
Right? Because it doesn't lead us towards a solution. It leads us towards some kind of brokering and negotiations. And everyone ends up in a playground sort of situation where I'm not doing anything if you don't do anything. Right. And then no one does anything.
And that's an argument I'm hearing about Canada. People saying, you know, why are we doing this when, you know, Canada's contribution might only be like a minuscule in the global
picture here. It's about 1%, as I understand it. Yeah. So I completely understand why people say that. But at the same time, we are all collectively responsible.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can't take that viewpoint, because if you take that viewpoint, you literally stop it from progressing. Right?
And
I do agree that the pressure has to be put on the big emitters like China and the
India.
US and so on.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's obviously a part of it, but we all have to do it together, basically, which is not always an easy thing.
So will this week of climate action and this climate strike, will that accomplish anything, or is it just, you think,
awareness?
More show.
I mean, I think it's accomplishing something already. I mean, the mere fact that Greta Thunberg is getting criticism from like very senior people in certain governments tells you that a lot of people are quite nervous about this. I mean, and we should be, because we got to do something. I'm totally for sustainable development, right? I strongly believe in the necessity of having some kind of economic system that works and provides jobs for people, although the future of that may be a little bit uncertain as we go into a more and more technological society. But anyway, we can still do that in a sustainable way. The challenge that we have is very large industries that drive the economy are obviously enormously entrenched in the political system, right? Because they have a lot of interest. They're serving a lot of people. There's a lot of jobs, and it's completely understandable. But we have to find some kind of route to actually move us forward in a way that doesn't leave potentially like sea levels that are several feet higher. I mean, look what that would do downtown. It's kind of crazy. Really.
Seriously, PEI would basically vanish. Yeah. Parts of Florida would be no longer there. But how amazing is it that this 16-year-old young student from Sweden has basically taken the world by storm here, and that if not for her, I'm not sure that we'd be talking about this as much as we are of late.
Well, she's become something of a beacon of hope.
Seriously.
Right?
Yeah.
So, amazing individual, and a really interesting individual as well when you look at what Greta's going through and so on. So I'm truly, truly amazed by how she keeps on doing this, to be honest, because she's getting criticism from everyone. She's a 16-year-old kid who's like having senior people in government saying, well, you don't know anything, go home, and so on. So it's really interesting to see her keep going. I mean, I hope that this does spur some kind of bigger discussion. I mean, I don't have children myself, so I'm still nonetheless very worried about what the future of our planet will be. And we have stories here, like how the environment is changing. Like one in four birds dead since 1970 as a relative population number. So there's things going on that we need to address. And as I said, I'm totally supportive of sustainable development, and I believe in the value of jobs and figuring out a way for the economy to move forward.
I like her message to the U.S. Congress last week. Don't listen to me. Listen to the science. Listen to the facts.
Yeah, I mean, the harsh reality in all of this is, and you get this situation where people go, I'm not going to do anything unless you tell me exactly what's going to happen, right? Unless you know exactly every single detail, then I'm not going to do anything. And that just doesn't work, because science isn't like that. Science cannot predict the future perfectly, right? But we do have pretty good climate models. They're not perfect. No one's going to say they're perfect, but they are pretty darn good. If you look at their historical modeling of the temperature track, which we have, they actually produce it within bounds of error really quite well. So the models are actually pretty darn good. And then you can put in whatever scenarios you want, and you see the overall temperature changes.
Jillian just tweeted to say that Greta Thunberg is a force. I can't handle criticism at 38 as well as she has at 16.
Yeah, yeah.
The world needs her, right?
Yeah,
so
no,
Jillian,
absolutely, absolutely.
Rick's giving us a call with a question here in regards to clean energy. Rick, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Just on the Greta thing. She has two books, right? Did you know about that? She has two books out. One is out already and the other one's coming.
Okay.
And in the first book, she claims, or her mother claims, that Greta can see carbon dioxide gas with her eyes. So I'll just throw that out there for you. That's actually in her book. So
really? Okay.
I don't take her too seriously myself, but
here's
my question for Rob, okay?
Yep.
Okay.
Should we, in order to stop CO2 from going to the atmosphere, should we focus on nuclear energy?
All right.
And I just have one sidebar to that. Back in 1981, Elizabeth May asked me to go to Point Lepreau, New Brunswick, to protest against the soon-to-be-opened Point Lepreau nuclear plant, because I wrote a song about it, and it was an anti-nuke song. Anyway, everything I wrote in the song did not come true over the past 40 years. I guess you could call me a skeptic.
There you go. Climate change denier, in fact. And let's hear what Dr. Rob's got to say about this.
So I'm a physicist, so I have a reasonable understanding of the impacts of nuclear power and the fundamental problems associated with it, which are primarily the radioactive byproducts that it creates. And so the thing that concerns most people is what happens if there's an accident, and then what happens with the storage of this material. And so the honest answer is, if there's an accident, most nuclear power stations are, in fact, pretty well contained in terms of the type of meltdowns that you can have. Now, there are releases, and there have been releases that are well documented, but the number of deaths from those is probably significantly less than the overall number of deaths from particulate from coal-fired power stations around the world, right? So from that perspective, they're not as bad as you might think. Where you sort of have the question marks about nuclear power is long-term storage, because some of the uranium-processed nuclear power stations produce byproducts, like different isotopes, that have half-lives in the tens of thousands of years. So that's radioactive for a very long time, and it is difficult to store. There's no getting away from that. We're just looking at geological timescales for storing this, right? So that is an issue. And no one wants it stored in their backyard, and I completely understand that. So there have been suggestions of different places to store them in deserts and so on that are geologically stable, but the answer is over a long term. We really don't know how geologically stable certain areas are. We don't have that information. So, yes, they do have a number of issues with them, but the long answer is I would certainly be keen to see some kind of closer inspection of thorium nuclear power. And also there's fusion in the background, but fusion is incredibly hard to do, and we've been trying to do this for 50 years, and we still haven't got there, because it's literally difficult to develop the materials to build the fusion reactors, which essentially have hardly any byproducts.
But is nuclear power then the answer to, again, these ongoing concerns about the coal-fired generating plants and so on and so forth?
So where I would say nuclear power comes in is whatever you do, if you build some kind of renewable grid, you are still going to need some kind of backup power there. And so it could be part of that. I wouldn't go to nuclear as the whole solution because there are options that we can do in terms of like more localized generation and so on. So I don't see it as the absolute solution at all. I just see it as part of a wider solution.
Mm. I remember some years back there was a discussion about perhaps how to get rid of the nuclear waste. That you're right. It's very much just sits in pools now outside these power plants and very difficult to deal with. Someone had suggested, and there's some study done in this, in drilling holes into the granite or the rock of the Canadian Shield and storing it there. Was that feasible at all?
So, that is feasible. But again, the issue with that is what happens if you have a major fault or something like that. So the idea that people look at is sort of like, you enclose it in this very large piece of granite that isn't going to have a fault in it, but you can never say that. Right?
Yeah.
You can't. And so there may be some kind of leaching. They're in barrels. The barrels break down after a few thousand years and so on. So it's not easy stuff to store. I'm never going to argue that it is. It's not. And that is one of the big problems that we have to address with it. But there are alternatives. And the harsh reality is, I mean, ironically, my wife is working on arsenic. I mean, that was in the ground, right?
Mm.
So you can store things in the ground for long periods of time and not have them actually come back and hurt you. But I don't see this as the absolute solution at all. I see this as just part of something. Renewables, whether it's solar, whether it's wind and so on, are a way forward that works.
I've got Katie did just a little research after Rick's call there about Greta Thunberg, or Thunberg rather, and her book. And indeed, her mother did say in the book, that Greta is able to see what other people cannot see. She can see carbon dioxide with the naked eye. She sees how it flows out of chimneys and changes the atmosphere in a landfill. Katie just added her own personal note here. Personally, she says, I don't think she means this literally, but I guess that's up for interpretation.
It could be something that's said in a very figurative way, I suppose, but... Yeah, no, you can't see CO2.
No. 10:45, he is Dr. Rob Thacker, and this is Science Files. Bonita, stay there, you're coming up. But first, we have to take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this. 10:48 on a Monday morning. Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker, and Bonita is on the line. Good morning, Bonita.
Morning, gentlemen.
Hi, Bonita.
My question is, why are most planets round instead of like oval or something?
Okay.
If they're spinning so fast and they've got like other like things like comets and asteroids or whatever bumping into them at, you know, like really fast speeds. And like why are they round instead of more oval?
Okay, that's a good question.
So the answer are they are a little bit oval. So you've mentioned spin, and spin will actually prolate them, as we call them, or flatten them out just a tiny little bit. Not very much, but just a tiny little bit. So you're right to think that they should be a little bit squished, and they are, but a very small amount. But the reason why planets tend to be round is energy. And so if you take a bunch of material and you have it all attracting itself by the gravitational force, and that's obviously what keeps a planet together, then the most efficient and energy-efficient way of having that material aligned is to have it in a sphere, right? And everything naturally does that. The universe is actually kind of lazy, right? The universe always wants to get into its least energy configuration, and so the sphere is the configuration of material that has the least amount of potential energy.
So I'll explain then this moon off, I can't remember if it's Jupiter or Saturn or Neptune, that looks like it's just... People took their, someone took the rocks and just kind of squished
and
them all together.
I've got an answer.
There are pieces missing from this oval.
So what really is the determining factor is how big is the object? Because when an object is small, say the size of a table or something like that, the overall amount of gravitational attraction that feels is very low. And so what then ends up setting the structure of the object is actually the overall force inside the object, the structural forces that keep it together. So you can have a whole bunch of rocks, they come together and they kind of stick under their mutual gravity, but they aren't squished by gravity into a sphere because they're too strong for that relative to the amount of gravity you have.
Okay. Bonita, does that answer your question?
Sort of, but you're saying so the planets are stronger inside than outside, and that's how they sort of keep the shape?
I'm saying that they're not strong enough to resist gravity sort of squishing them into a sphere. That's probably the best way to think about it.
Okay.
Hopefully it helps.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Benita. Bye-bye. I was down on the South Shore on the weekend, sitting out on a back deck looking into the clear blue sky.
Mm-hmm.
This is around noontime and into the afternoon. I can see the moon. I can see the moon.
Oh, noontime.
The
any jokes
day.
About what were you drinking? I can't say that.
But the whole day I could see the moon, and then at nighttime came the moon was gone. Why
yeah,
is that?
No, that happens all the time, though. I mean, so people often sort of say, why can I see the moon during the day? You effectively see the moon during the day almost as much as you do during the night. It's just that you're not looking for it.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
It goes around the Earth, so it has to mean that as the Earth spins around, you'll see it as it moves to the different parts. Like when you have a new moon, it's really close to the sun and so on. When you have a full moon, it's on the exact opposite side relative to the sun, right? So it's going all the way around. And so, yeah, it's up there during the daytime, and sometimes it's not going to be around at nighttime.
So it orbits the Earth as opposed to locked in a particular...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Anyways, just I thought it was... rather kind of interesting. Just
yeah, no, I mean, I
nice
remember
summer,
being a kid and sort of looking up and going, why can I see the moon during the day? And you can.
Yeah.
Right? You can.
10:51, most massive neutron star ever detected, almost too massive to exist, is the headline in a Science Daily report. Let's hear more about this, and first tell me, what the heck is
a neutron
star?
Yes.
And why is it so massive?
All right, so neutron stars are really interesting objects. They're probably... they are the densest object we know of the universe that isn't a black hole, right? And so it's very difficult to say what the actual density of a black hole is, but neutron stars we know. And these are literally the endpoints of really, really big stars. You have supernova explosions, but you can actually have a core left over that's created as a whole bunch of material collapses down under huge pressures and then is turned into what is effectively a giant atom.
Okay.
Right? It's all made of neutrons. Nuclei of atoms are made of protons and neutrons normally. And so then you would have electrons around it. So whereas a neutron star, you actually have a whole bunch of neutrons all squished together in something the size of a city or something like that, but weighs the equivalent of a star. Hmm. Right? So they're incredibly massive, but incredibly dense. You couldn't survive on the surface of one. You could be crushed out of existence. But they have all sorts of physics going on them that's really amazing, right? So we're super interested in them. They can release flares, have really, really strong magnetic fields around them, and just they are this exotic state of matter, as we call them. And so what the interesting thing about them is that as they get sort of bigger, more massive, there is a certain point called the Oppenheimer-Volkov-Tolman limit, I think that's it, where above that, the force that kind of keeps them supported against collapsing against gravity isn't strong enough. And then poof, they become a black hole.
Oh, okay.
So there's kind of like, you get sort of like one solar mass, you get two solar masses, and then somewhere above two solar masses is the most massive mass that they can be before they collapse into a black hole. And so there's a race to find the biggest one that you can, because that tells you where or you're getting closer and closer to the limit. So it's always interesting when they say they found a new, more massive neutron star, because that's moving the Oppenheimer-Tolman-Volkov limit.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
We got time for Ryan here with a question. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going, Rick?
Going well, sir. How are you today?
Good, good. Just driving up the Eastern Shore here, and I'm still getting your radio station in, and it got me thinking of a question for Rob as I was driving.
Okay.
So maybe I'm about, give or take, 2-3 hours away from Halifax here now, and I'm still getting the radio signal in every, pretty good. It's a little blotchy if we go down into some of the valleys here. But I'm assuming it's the ocean that's carrying the signal so far. Would that be correct to assume?
That's a good assumption. Just let me tell a little story here.
Okay.
Just an add-on to that question.
Yep.
How come, like, I almost lose the station in Truro if I'm driving to Truro? But I'm like further away here now, so that's why it kind of got me curious on the question there. Anyway, I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
I appreciate that. Okay. Now, back in the day when I lived and worked in Newcastle, I used to drive to Trackety on a regular basis, and there was a stretch on that road that came across basically the open water, and we used to sit there at night, park there, and go through our AM radio band and pick up stations around the world. Now, AM signals are shot up into the air, bounce off the atmosphere, and come down. FM signals travel basically parallel to the ground, right?
So,
simply put.
It's going to depend precisely on the frequency, because with shortwave, you're certainly right. Shortwave can actually bounce off the atmosphere and come back down again. And so they actually use tracers from meteorites coming in and bounce signals off those. It depends upon the type of... So the one thing that's causing me pause about water is that when you have, say, a transmitter and receiver over water, and then you have a wavelength of... that just happens to bounce off the water, you'll also have the wavelength that goes straight from one thing to another. So you have two paths, and you can get interference because of that.
Okay.
Right? And so that can actually stop you from being able to receive signals. But it's all wavelength dependent, and I really should know what the wavelength of FM radio is, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah, I know that, again, depending on weather conditions, you can hear us all the way down to Liverpool, for example, on some days, and some days you can't pick us up at all. And that he mentioned Truro. When you drive into Truro and you go down the kind of gully out, you lose most of the radio stations, at least in Halifax. And then you come outside the gully. And again, that's the FM signal that is basically just runs kind of perpendicular.
Then you're saying that there's some kind of atmospheric waveguide effect.
Yeah.
And so I certainly know that that can happen over the Bay of Fundy when you have temperature inversions over the water. And that will happen in optical wavelengths as well. So when you see, it's called... Morgana something. I can't remember the exact name for them. But so if you look at Eel Holt in particular out over the Bay of Fundy, when there's a temperature inversion, you'll see like the very edges of it will actually suddenly look like they're standing up really, really tall, and it looks really strange.
Oh, okay.
Right? And that's what's happening then, that you're getting actual waveguide effect for the light coming from, and it's being bent upwards and then flat and coming to you. So it magnifies something effectively.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Have to get a radio engineer in here to kind of...
No, they would. I mean, this is, funnily enough, so someone was asking me from CBC about this, and I said, well, you just get a radio engineer because they know where they have to put the transmitters, they know about interference and so on, so...
Maybe you'll get them to come in next week and just kind of enlighten us on...
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Dr. Rob, time's up. Appreciate you dropping by again this Monday morning. Thank you very much. We covered a lot of ground again. We didn't talk about the birds issue, but we'll get into that perhaps next week.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, North America's lost billions of birds since 1970, according to a new study. We'll hear more next week. Dr. Rob, thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. Rob Thacker with us here on a Monday morning. And, of course, he's St. Mary's University astrophysicist, and he'll be with us again next Monday. 2 minutes now before 11 o'clock. We're going to break here for a news update coming up at the top of the hour. Then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday. Anything goes in our open hours, and our phone lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Give me a call. We'll take those calls after the news, and it's coming up next.